It seems like all or nothing these days when it comes to religion, and it's the secularists in the middle who are being squeezed from both sides. So says our guest this morning, who's beating the drum to encourage moderates of all stripes to rally around secularism to preserve one of our country's founding principles. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Jacques Berliner-Blau. He teaches at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service and hosts the Secular Center and Faith Complex. His latest book is called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And we want to hear from you this hour. Do you see secularism as an endangered species? And what do we lose if we lose the sacred or the secular strand of America? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also find us on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. Jacques Berliner-Blau, good to have you with us.
Veronica, great to be here.
Well, sometimes it can seem these days like secularism is a dirty word. What do you make of the way that word is used today?
Yeah, it's used by two different groups who really don't like one another in very, very different ways. The religious right uses it as a sort of synonym for contumely and rapine and moral recklessness and the collapse of the American value system. On the other side, there are groups such as extreme atheists who have tried to appropriate the word as their own, and they see what they're doing as a form of secularism as well, which I don't quite think it is.
So what's the difference then?
Well, the difference is that secularism is a political worldview. It's really about how we properly calibrate the relationship between government and religion. It's not a metaphysical statement about whether God exists or not. As I like to say, secularism is agnostic on the question of God. It's a great question. I think it should be pursued. I just don't think it falls within the legitimate purview of secularism.
And what do you think it is? Has the definition evolved, I guess, over time? The way we perceive secularism is how it should truly be seen as you see it.
Yeah, it evolves constantly, and that's a good thing. There have been certain radical ruptures in how we understand the term. I would say that the political idea, the political conception of secularism, and I repeat, because a lot of people have a hard time with this, secularism is a variety of ways of thinking about how government and religion can best interact with one another. As American history has progressed, well, we've come a long way, baby. We've come pretty far from Mr. Jefferson's 1802 Danbury letter, where he lays out this wall metaphor, which is interesting because it's a metaphor he never used again, and we often wonder what he meant by that. There's a difference between Jefferson's secularism, if you will, though he never used the term, of 1802, and the type of heavy legal separationism that we saw from the United States Supreme Court around mid-century. Those are different types of secularism. And then there is the kind of secularism of extreme atheists, which sort of advocates that religion is a problem. It's a metric of a cognitive delusion. It needs to be expurgated from the social body in order for the common good to be achieved. So we've seen, yeah, a lot of metamorphosis in the definition.
I guess it just evolves in terms of how we think about our society and our government and how we want that to work. And it seems like these days the push is on to desecularize society.
Right. The push that seems to be working, there is a push to secularize society, but that doesn't seem to be working too well. The push that seems to be working is emanating from the religious right. And as I argue in the book, the religious right experienced the 60s, and to put it mildly, they didn't like what they saw. So they emerged in the 70s, particularly after the Roe v. Wade decision, energized, focused, and having identified an enemy. And the name of the enemy was secularism or secular humanism, which they saw as a synonym for atheism, communism, Ted Kennedy, you name it, the Democratic Party, right? They had lined up all of these isms and things that they didn't like at all under the banner of secularism, gay rights, women's rights, the explosion of the porn industry. All this stuff was kind of put under one rubric, secularism. They found a handy enemy, and they beat that enemy mercilessly with their stick.
Well, so what happens if we move in that direction in this country? What do you think is at stake?
Well, we're a very, very religiously diverse country, and the American ecumenical environment is pretty serene compared to the religious environment of other countries. My mother is from France, and whenever we used to walk through the streets of my native Brooklyn, it sounds like I'm writing a novel, The Streets of My Native Brooklyn, she used to snicker whenever she saw two churches facing one another, let's say a Methodist church here and a Catholic church, like just across the street from one another. And for years, I had no idea why she found that so funny. And then it hit me that architecturally, that just didn't happen in the Paris of her youth. Usually, the religious institutions, for very good reasons, were kind of far away from one another. So the American tale of religious as opposed to racial interaction is a pretty serene and calm one. My argument is secularism is greatly responsible for that. And by maintaining a strong secular state, we maintain the serenity, we maintain the peace, we maintain the tranquility. We don't visit these dark corners that we've been pretty fortunate as Americans in not often visiting.
Well, so religious pluralism, you know, that I guess that impulse that drove the Puritans here, the freedom to exercise their own religion is what you think is at stake. And that's, I guess, it's a pretty big thing.
Yeah, it's a big thing. The thing with the Puritans is as soon as they got here, they done went and reversed the whole equation, and they were phenomenally intolerant towards other religious traditions. You wouldn't want to be a Quaker, for example, living in 17th century Puritan villages. This always ended badly, as the Salem witchcraft trials also bring to our attention. So a lot of people advocate secular ideals when they are in the minority or when they're pressed. And this is a big problem for secularism, because once these groups achieve majority status, they're not that into it anymore. They're like, well, why not? Why don't we do it our way? Here's a really good example. Some of the greatest exponents of the classic secular vision have been Baptists. That often puzzles a lot of people. And roughly around 1990 or so, I believe the Southern Baptist Convention said goodbye to all that. And my understanding is they said goodbye to all that. This is my analysis, not theirs. Because they realize, hey, we're the second largest religious denomination in the United States. We're not a minority. We have power. We have clout. We can influence legislators in state houses. We can make a more godly America cast in the image of the way we see things. Now, of course, there are still some Baptist groups that cling to the old image that the Baptists had as religious dissenters and folks that were on the on the business side of religious oppression, and those groups are in the minority of Baptists. So I guess to wrap up what I'm saying, secularism is something that groups that are small and vulnerable nearly always applaud and appreciate. When they get larger, unfortunately, sometimes they forget that.
Well, to look at some of the reasons that some of these groups might be moving to desecularize, I'm sure depending on the group, the opinion varies, but there are countries that seem to be, based on what we hear and what is reported, truly secular countries. You know, Canada mm-hmm. is one that I hear a lot. Canada, I keep hearing, is a secular country. Religion is moving away, is slipping away as a bedrock right. of Canadian society. America, you don't hear that about. America, you hear as a genuinely religious country, even though there are all kinds of iterations of that expression. If it is a religious country, why not see that reflected in its governance?
Right. I just want to stress that secular, as you know very well, secular and religion are not antonyms. They're not opposites, right? It is a religious country that has a sort of secular cast about its religiosity. So if the question is, why is America different? That's a great question. That's a kind of, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville sort of question. The American exception, here's something that's interesting. You mentioned Canada. Let me mention its kind of weird godparent, France. If you look at the birth of the United States and the birth of modern France, or at least revolutionary France, the First Republic, what's really interesting is that the Americans had no conception in their worldview of people who hated religion, didn't believe in God, thought faith was an evil. That just isn't present in the founding generation of American theorists. The French are saturated with these dudes, right? Whether it be Voltaire or Rousseau or some of the Radical Enlightenment philosophers. In other words, what I'm saying is when France is born, there are a lot of people saying religion is a problem. The Catholic Church has to be suppressed. We'd be off a lot better if we worshipped either a deist divinity or no divinity at all. Those voices aren't present at the birth of the United States. So we've never had the ability to conceptualize a space for people who simply don't believe in God, or perhaps believe in God in very, very idiosyncratic and peculiar ways.
So you're saying that the U.S. has grown up differently in the way that it thinks about religion. Maybe it's sort of like analogous to not having baggage from your parents. You move on, you have a clean conscience, and you don't feel dysfunctional about religion. And that's why you think that this is happening?
And it's basically been successful when you think about it. We do have a pretty good, I don't want to sugarcoat this, but compared to other countries, compared to Germany, to France, England, we have a pretty good track record of religious peace in this country. It is in many ways, compared to India, for example, right? It's kind of a light unto the nations in that sense. So something has clearly worked in American history. You can ask American Jews what they think about the United States. Their patriotism is second to none. You can ask Catholics, by the way, who did have a very, very difficult time, and we tend to forget that in the 19th century, what they think about the United States. And they feel the United States is theirs. Mormonism is like the quintessential American religion. Of course, they too endured their slights and indignity. So something is working in the United States vis-a-vis our pluralistic experiment. And I don't want to break this down to, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, or whatever that might be. But I'd like people to ask themselves why this country, with all of its other problems, especially on the racial front, has always managed to generally avoid these types of religious implosions.
Well, if it's true that secularism has worked in this country and that we don't have this dysfunction surrounding religion, this vein of deep animosity for various reasons, what do you think you would say to, say, someone, as you said, on the Christian right, who said, well, why can't we see that expressed? Why do we need this wall of separation between church and state, for instance, if it's working in America and we seem to be doing okay with how we handle religious pluralism?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing I would say to the person on the religious right is read your own scriptures. There's a real quiescent streak in the New Testament in particular. I mean, there are verses like Romans 13:1 and 13:2 that really tell Christians to be wary of politics, that politics is corrupting, that render unto Caesar what is his, leave it alone, right? The real kingdom of God is in the next world. And what's really interesting, what I discovered while researching this book, is somebody like the Reverend Jerry Falwell used to say things like that. Isn't that fascinating, right? Mm-hmm. Prior to his re-entry into the American political theater, where he basically realigned American politics, quite frankly, we should never underestimate his accomplishment, we have sermons of him urging preachers to get out of politics, particularly because of the specter of integration and the civil rights movement, which he did not like. So he's begging his more liberal evangelical colleagues. Well, he's actually a fundamentalist, but anyhow, he's begging them to get out of politics because Christians don't do politics. So the first thing I would say, Veronica, to that gentleman or that woman on the religious right that says, well, we need more of it, is, well, read some of your scriptures anyhow. This is really part of the Christian tradition. And as I go to great pains to argue in the book, secularism emerges from Christian political philosophy. No Christian political philosophy, as far as I can tell, I'm not sitting in the studio with Veronica discussing secularism today.
So if it emerges out of Christianity, the secular thread, I guess the question is why? Was it a religious, as you kind of indicated there with what you quoted, an idea that religion and politics, there's something that dirtied the waters about politics, or was it a protective motion from Christians?
Yep. That's a really interesting question. This is where we get to the term culture wars. I think from the Scopes trial forward, so let's say from 1925 to the present, America really changed on a lot of fronts. I'll give you just a couple. The United States Supreme Court started making decisions that were liberalizing various aspects of American society in a way that the old Protestant majority really couldn't couldn't stomach. Religious minorities and racial and ethnic minorities came to play a larger and more prominent role in the United States demographically, and also because their civil rights were being increasingly assured. Sexual minorities, such as our lesbian and gay friends, were starting to find their own voice. Women were starting to find their own voice. And all of this comes together, really kind of crests in the 1960s. And I think the 1960s is the moment that those who are now part of what we call the Christian right — here's a fun fact for you, Veronica — evangelicals traditionally voted Democrat from FDR forward. A lot of people tend to forget that, right? So they look around, they look at the culture, they see the women's lib, they see the gay rights, they see the ethnic rights movements, they see the protests against Vietnam, they see the breakout, and I always mention this because I think it's important, the breakout of the pornography industry. They see Hollywood liberalizing, and they decide they want to take back the culture. Right? They come to the conclusion that what is happening in American society writ large somehow impacts or degrades or corrupts their own godliness or what God thinks of them. And they enter the political arena, and as we say in French, chapeau bas, hats off, they get organized real fast, and they make their perspective rather well known.
And so what's the outgrowth of that, then? Is that what we're seeing right now, this move?
Yeah, what we're I think this last congressional class is kind of, I don't want to say the high watermark, because it can actually go higher, but I think we're seeing a lot of these processes that were put into play in the 70s and 80s really cresting and peaking. I would hope they're cresting and peaking. I hope there's not a higher ceiling that we can't imagine. But we're seeing the Christian right, which is a very diverse and complex entity. It's not one thing. But we're seeing it like it's Promethean. It's just everywhere, right? The personhood amendments, for example. In my book, I talk about this controversy in Texas about getting Mr. Jefferson out of the Enlightenment module, right? The explosion of anti-gay agenda, all right? So you're hearing this stuff every single day. And I think secular liberals — there are secular conservatives, but secular liberals — are in this constant state of saying, whoa, what's going on here? Who are these people, right? And there's this impression that these people, whoever they are this weird fringe minority. And everything is indicating to me this is not a fringe minority. There are a lot of Americans that subscribe to this worldview. And secularism has to wake up and understand who these Americans are and why they believe this to be true. And I think obviously the first step is a type of constructive engagement and an open dialogue about what our values are as Americans. But secularists are way behind the ball here. They're really in a state of disrepair, as I say from like the first sentence of the book.
Well, you're talking about a culture clash or a culture war that's played out over like 30, 40 years. That's an awful long time if it sounds like one side didn't even know they were in a war.
Right.
How do you see that playing out then?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure one side didn't know they were in a war. I mean, you have many liberals in the 70s and 80s and 90s who are like, uh-oh, this is not good. Like, what's going on here? Who are these guys? Right. I don't think they understood the organization, the discipline, the focus of their opponents, and they, the term I use in the book, they were out-generaled just on every turn, right? They're on legal minutiae in state houses, right? They get procedured down, right? It's really quite fascinating, and it's a great case study in how social movements are built in the United States. I quite frankly don't know what secularists were doing or thinking in the 80s and the 90s. I think they were thinking, this is just a fringe. It's going to go away. Most Americans are like us. The majority is with us. And then all of a sudden, in 2008, 2010, especially at the midterm elections, surprise, that's not the case.
Our guest this hour is Jacques Berliner Blau. He teaches at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And we're talking about his new book this hour. It's called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And we'd love to hear your voice this hour, be it on email or on our phones, on our Facebook page. Do you see secularism as an endangered species? And do you think we lose something if we get farther away from that secular strand of America? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
one time I was in my car in a parking lot, and I had my daughter in the back seat. She was busy doing up her seatbelt, and it was taking a long time, and someone was waiting for the parking spot. I'd indicated to the person with the universal symbol of, my daughter's in the back seat, trying to indicate that she's putting up the seatbelt. The person obviously got mad, but took the time and liberty to roll down their window and scream, go back to your country. They left after saying that to me, and I followed them, and I asked them to stop. It was in a very public place with lots of people around, so there were some kind of precautions. But I asked the person to stop, and I asked them if they realized how hurtful they were being. I asked them if they understood that it made no sense, that I was born here, I've never lived anywhere else, I speak English, I'm American, and if they had thought about that. So it made me think that perhaps it was more about anger than hatred towards me or any group. You know, people harbor hatred in their heart, but when it comes to the surface, it comes with anger. You know, frequently it comes with anger.
And that was Dr. Jerusha Lamptey, a visiting professor at Georgetown University and a convert to Islam, recalling an incident of racial intolerance that she experienced. I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk this hour about the call to renew secular America with our guest Jacques Berliner-Blau, who teaches at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And his new book is called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And Jacques, tell us a little bit about how you hear that clip we just heard.
You know, it's a very, very painful clip. That's a show that I produce, and now I have my students doing most of the hosting. It's one of the things I'm most proud about. We're trying to think outside of the box at Georgetown, and we're trying to get students involved in media on every level. The interviewer there was Caitlin McNellis, and she was speaking. She's a sophomore in the School of Foreign Service. She was interviewing Dr. Lamptey, who is a scholar at Georgetown University, and they were speaking about Islamophobia. I think Islamophobia is real in the United States. I feel a secular state would go very, very far, a true secular state, in trying to reduce or mitigate this type of almost relentless dislike of others, be they Sikhs or be they Muslims. And if we want to move it to the non-religious sphere, gay Americans or lesbian Americans. One other thing I do think, now I'm a New Yorker, and when I go to Washington, D.C., it seems like the Deep South to me, and people laugh when I say that. I have family, by the way, out in your parts, in Minnesota, right across the way from Wisconsin. I am puzzled sometimes by the types of worldviews I find in places that are not major urban centers in the United States. I'm also puzzled by what I see in the urban centers, but on other issues. What could a secular state do to address Dr. Lamptey's concerns? A secular state could really play a role in education and helping people understand who these other religious groups are. A secular state could also vitiate or obliterate this idea that this country is a Christian nation and that Muslim Americans or Sikh Americans or Jewish Americans, you name them, Buddhists, right, are somehow tolerated guests here. And that's a very, very important conception of American secularism.
You're talking like we're not a secular country. I think probably most people would assume that we are at some form right now. Are you saying that people, it may be a name only, that we're not really walking the line?
Yeah, I don't think we're, well, it depends. In New York, we're secular. I can assure you of that, right? In downtown Manhattan, we're secular. In other parts of the country, my informants are telling me they don't feel it's that secular. They're telling me that they were subjected to prayer circles in their public schools. They're telling me that because they were gay, they were just bullied constantly. And there was just nobody there to help. And again, this is a regional problem. I don't want to close my eyes to what I do think is a kind of, you know, city versus country problematic in the United States. So how about this, Veronica? Let's meet one another halfway. There are parts of the country where the secular vision is clearly understood and we play by the secular rules of the game. There are other parts of the country where we are not playing by the secular rules of the game. And an efficient secular state can somehow make sure that there is a homogeneity or an evenness in these various spaces.
Was there a golden age when you would have said that we really were living up to the word and what it means in our life as a country and a people?
There was a momentum. I don't think we ever quite got there. There was a momentum, I think, from the 1947 United States Supreme Court Everson decision forward. You see tremendous energy on the part of the courts to create an America that is quite aware of the status of religious minorities, that is even willing to imagine what it might be like to be a non-believer and to be forced to take an oath or to mention God's name in order to be employed, let's say, in Maryland or to receive benefits from the state. So I think from the 40s to the 70s, we have legally anyhow the makings of a really intriguing American experiment in a type of hardcore separationist secularism, a little too separationist for me, quite frankly, which is really quite encouraging. Now, I don't want to give the impression that I think we're living in a Talibanized America. That's not at all what I'm saying. What I'm saying is America has become a field of tremendous contestation on these church-state issues, and the battlefields are many and diverse. And depending on where you go, one will find a different secular status to the region in question.
Well, I want to get some of our callers and our listeners in on this. And let's take our first phone call now. We've got Darren joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Darren.
Yes, good morning. I 100% agree with your guest's position. As a gay man, I lived in the ex-gay lifestyle for about 10 years, and I was part of the religious right. I was one of those Santorum supporters. However, I've come to realize that that's a lie. And I see that with Rick Santorum and Paul Ryan, for example, you contrast that with John Kennedy, who went to Dallas in 1959 during the campaign, or I should say 1960, and where he said that he would not be taking orders from the Vatican. And you contrast that with Rick Santorum, who went to Dallas and said that he would inculcate his faith into public policy. I find that very frightening, and I'm also very concerned about, and this is one of my big pet peeves, with both political parties, and we saw it last night with the God bless America, God bless the troops. You know, I go to a Unitarian-type fellowship now. I'm a recovering Catholic, and I don't want to hear our public leaders invoke God. Hitler invoked God during World War II. FDR invoked God during World War II. Can we just keep God out of the equation here in public discourse?
Well, thanks a lot, Darren. Lots of good points there. You want to start with the last one, Jacques? What about the way that God has become a part of every political speech for major office that you hear lately, and you don't hear many squeaks about that?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you, Darren. He makes the first point I'm in total agreement with, but let's get to the second point. The God Bless America, shall we say, hymns that we hear, my advice to American secularists, who does it upset? Let's start there. It usually upsets non-believers, and I think they have a right to feel perturbed by that. It does upset certain types of religious believers, maybe kind of old school hardcore Baptists that get very nervous anytime the church and the state touch one another. My advice, however, Darren, on that issue is just let it go. James Madison once wrote about some of the problems he had negotiating these complex church-state issues, and he spoke of the unessential differences, minor differences. There are certain things that even though one wishes they wouldn't happen, they're going to happen, and they're not important enough to make a major fuss over. So the God Bless America, I understand the anger, and I think it's a legitimate frustration that many non-believers have with having it rammed down their throat. I just think it's an unwinnable battle, and in many ways an unnecessary battle. So tactically, in my book, I urge secularists to lay off that, lay off the creche activism. The creche activism is like when a statue of baby Jesus pops up in front of a post office or something and the ACLU goes into overdrive. I just don't think secularism has the person power right now to deal with this sort of stuff, though I don't want to sound so completely oblivious to the I don't want to say pain, but the frustration it creates in non-believers. On the other point that Darren made, and it's a really important point, yes, Rick Santorum is really quite interesting. In fact, Rick Santorum told George Stephanopoulos that upon hearing John Kennedy's famous 1960 oration, he wanted to vomit. He actually doubled down. He had said it previously, and Stephanopoulos asked him. He said, yeah, I did, in fact, want to vomit when I heard that speech. So Santorum clearly has set that speech within its sights. Now, what Darren doesn't mention, I'm sure he's aware of it, is Mitt Romney in 2007 gave a speech called Faith in America, which is a much more cerebral and well-thought-out assault on John Kennedy's 1960 speech. So I would advise all listeners to just listen to Romney in 2007, and it has the dignity of thought and eloquence. And what I saw in 2007 is I saw Santorum coming, right? I saw when Romney was hitting these points, and they were very, very cleverly expressed, it struck me that they were intellectuals within the fold of the Republican Party who were conceptualizing a dismantling of the strong, austere, noble, separationist experiment that John F. Kennedy was putting into play.
Now let's talk about Mitt Romney for a second, because in light of what we've been talking about this morning and who you said should be supporting secularism, if anybody should be supporting secularism, it should be Mitt Romney, right?
Right. Well, one of those Mitt Romneys used to support secular, and there are a lot of Mitt Romneys out there. Right?
I mean, these fringe, not majority groups, the minority groups who have the most at stake, who should be supporting secularism.
Right. Yeah, on Secular Center, I kind of do a voter's guide for secularists, and one thing I realized about Romney is there's a lot to like secularly about Romney. I've always tried. I've been writing for the Washington Post about religion and politics for 5 years, and I've always tried to see the good in Romney, because I think there actually is a lot of good there. So let's get to the good. The good is, as a religious minority, as a Mormon, and this is a group that, one, has encountered violence at the hands of its Protestant majority, and it's a group which is really tarred with a lot of nastiness, that they're weird and they have strange beliefs, and people are constantly, even comedians today, feel that it's okay to make fun of them publicly. I'm very uncomfortable with that. I just think we don't say things like that in public. We have full freedom of speech. I wish people wouldn't say those sorts of things. Romney, I think, gets it on minorities. I think he understands what it's like to be a small, vulnerable group amongst others. And the case in point is when Herman Cain was reflecting about his cabinet. I don't know if you remember this, Veronica. He was kind of thinking, like, if they were in a Cain administration, who would he have, chief of staff, whatever? And he didn't know if he wanted Muslims there. So it created a buzz. And Romney called him out on it at a debate. I think it might have been in October, one of those 19 debates that we endured. Romney kind of bravely, I would say, said, well, no, that's not the way we do things in America. We've always had a kind of respect for people who are different than we are, and we treasure religion, but we don't in any way draw distinctions on religion. So good for Romney. When Romney was governor of Massachusetts, I see no glaring record of church-state trespass or anything that would worry a secularist. It's when Romney started running in 2008, and his advisors, who knew that George W. Bush won because of the so-called values voters in 2004, who were mostly conservative Christians, that's when Romney flip-flopped, right? The anatomy of the flip-flop. That's when he became, in his own words, an evangelical Mormon. And everything about his positions changed except for his sensitivity to the religious minorities.
Hmm. You see that, it sounds like, as political pragmatism. Do you see it also as the outgrowth of what has been called the Mormon moment we're in, that maybe Mormons are mainstreaming and he's got less invested?
Yeah, but I mean, you're right. It is political pragmatism. To go back to Darren's point, Santorum, that's not pragmatism, all right? He is a true believer, all right? When you see Santorum speak, all right, this is not some consultant whispering in his ear, right? Santorum will say things on the campaign trail which are clearly not in his political interests, and once he realizes they're not in his political interests, he'll say them again louder, all right? So we're looking at two very different types of political creatures there. As for Mormonism, yeah, Mormonism is mainstreaming. What I often hear, people like Mormons. I mean, everyone knows Mormons, right? I mean, even in New York, people know Mormons, and Mormons are family people, and, you know, Mormons are very good in the professions. I mean, I'm not trying to say some of my best friends are Mormons, but I think there's like a very positive buzz around Mormonism in the United States, and you couple that with a secular ethos that says, and who cares whether they're Mormons or whether they're not Mormons. We like them as Americans, and we welcome their faith, and we draw no distinctions or no judgments. So, yes, the secular state, I feel, and the tradition of American secularism has created an America in which Mormons can assume their rightful place as loyal, patriotic, and respected citizens.
Hmm. Well, let's get in one more call now before the break. We've got Bill joining us from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just took you off speaker. Sorry. I have an interesting background in that I was raised as a devout Roman Catholic. My family doesn't have much in this long in this country. I'm only second generation from Germany, and I grew up in New Orleans area. And during the 60s, New Orleans perceived itself, contrary to what, I don't know, you know, what the image of it now is, quite a bit changed, but it saw itself as an island of enlightenment,
right,
and surrounded by, you know, Bible-thumping, Bible-belt rednecks. And you know, New Orleans was about 90% Roman Catholic at that time, and We definitely were conscious of the fact that you did not have a rosary in plain view when you were outside of that of the city. You did not have a St. Christopher medal sitting on your dashboard. You did not have any bumper sticker or any other kind of sign or anything that would show anyone that you had any Roman papist tendencies or whatever. You know, You had to blend in with the cross burning, Bible thumping, zeitgeist of the country, and so I never felt this sense of I never felt religious freedom in the sense we were free to be Catholics as long as we stayed with other Catholics.
Mm.
Now, as an atheist now, I'm recovering Roman Catholic. That's even worse. I mean, you cannot, in many circles, even in Madison, admit publicly that you're an atheist without expecting some pushback. And I see that this country is turning very much. You see a lot of religious groups are essentially abrogating the First Amendment. The First Amendment is sort of a social contract between the government and the church.
Saying, I want to get our guest in on that while we've got some time. Jacques, what do you make of what Bill said?
Well, first of all, New Orleans, City of a Million Dreams, that's a Dr. John song, I think. I love New Orleans. New Orleans is one of those great secular American cities. Minneapolis, which I tend to know, is another one like that. These cities that are secular doesn't mean they're not religious. I want to be very clear about that. They just let people breathe, all right? There's a breathe factor. There's oxygen. There's cultural oxygen there. Veronica, you didn't second me on Minneapolis. Isn't it a great city?
I love Minneapolis.
I noticed the silence. It's a little cold.
No, no, right. I have no beef against Minneapolis. It's a good place.
But let's
not Wisconsin.
Says, no, definitely not. Does it rival Madison?
No.
Let's
no.
get to what Bill said about atheists. Yeah, there's a problem here. He's right. There is anti-atheist prejudice in this country. And for some strange reason, it's like growing and diminishing at the same time. I mean, I think a lot of people in this country, as they wouldn't have been half a century ago, are like, sure, whatever, atheists. Yeah, I know atheists. Yeah. But then there's another kind of organized faction. And again, this is, I regret to say, amongst conservative Christendom, which has really upped the volume. Well, they've always been loud on the question of atheism and really turned it into a kind of stick by which they can beat this group, which is a very, very small, disorganized, and I want to be very clear about this, often poorly led and poorly counseled minority. Atheists make a lot of poor decisions on the PR level in the United States. So there is anti-atheist prejudice. It's a big problem. It has to be checked very carefully. I wanted to think deep about the problem in the book. And one conclusion I came to, and this goes back to something we were discussing earlier, Veronica, is there's no space in our founding documents for non-belief. Right. In the French founding documents, there are these little asides. Yeah, and if you don't like religion, good for you. You know, tant mieux, or whatever. I mean, knock yourself out. In the American documents, there's this assumption that there is God, and there are all these different Protestant sectaries, And we're not going to fight, because we saw what that led to in the 17th century, right? We're all going to be at peace under God, right? So there's this overarching framework that we all believe in God. And I can't find a space in those documents that says, and if you don't believe in God, that's good too. And that develops in America towards the ends of the 19th century with figures like Robert Ingersoll and the Free Thought Movement, right? Where all of a sudden you have people saying, well, what about us, right? So part of the theoretical problem that confronts folks like Bill and many other atheists is trying to ground the legitimacy of their atheist identity in these founding documents. And that's hard. So then you have to go to Supreme Court decisions, and that's where I think atheists can really make the legal claim that, you know, we have as much right to this country as anyone else. We're as American as anyone else. Please leave us alone and respect our civil rights.
Our guest this hour is Jacques Berliner-Blau. He teaches at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and blogs at the Chronicle of Higher Education. His new book is called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And we're interested in hearing what you have to say about that this hour. What do you think of the state of secularism in America? Are we still a secular country as you see it? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickard back with you this Friday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about the call to renew secular America with our guest Jacques Berliner-Blau, whose new book is called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And Jacques, I want to read an email here. This is Nate from Appleton, who would like you to comment on Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli, which states that the U.S. is not and never shall be a Christian nation. End quote. This treaty was passed unanimously during George Washington's presidency, and Jefferson was Secretary of State at the time. Therefore, were the Founding Fathers not crystal clear in their adherence to secularism?
Yep. Good call, Nate. I talk about the Treaty of Tripoli, Article 11. There's some historical complexities there that we all need to look into about translations and versions that appear in Arabic that don't appear in English. But it's all good. Here's the thing. There is the Treaty of Tripoli. What I notice is there's a kind of gunfight at the OK Corral when we go back to the founding documents. Those who wish for pure separationism in the United States crank out Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists, all right? Then they immediately go to the Treaty of Tripoli, and good for them, all right? The problem is that those who believe this is a Christian nation return fire with a nuclear arsenal of comments, asides, speeches, laws, ordinances, like the Northwest Ordinance, that seem to indicate the opposite. All right, so Nate is correct, all right? The Treaty of Tripoli is a really good piece of evidence to adduce, right, if you wanted to argue that the founders did not have anything like a Christian nation in mind. Here's the problem, Nate. All right, the problem is I can think of maybe two dozen documents, comments by Washington, Adams, even things that Jefferson and Madison said in some of their less lucid or thoughtful moments that indicate that these folks were at peace with something like establishment, or in some cases, state establishments. I don't think any of them were at peace with federal establishment. All right, so the Northwest Ordinance, the remarks that Newt Gingrich loves to cite by memory, is one example. Washington's farewell address is yet another example. The Adamses have half a dozen to a dozen remarks where again and again they talk about establishments being okay, right? Equitable and mild establishments on the state level aren't a problem, especially in Massachusetts. So something for those who are hardcore separationists to think about: what documents do you ground your claim, right, that this is a nation that believes in separation of church and state? They are there. Don't get me wrong. They are there. But it's not as easy as most people assume it is.
You know, we're living in a time where there's a great interest in looking back at what the founding fathers intended or didn't intend, and the closer you can get them to align with you, the more right you are. Are you kind of saying here that secularism's greatest strength cannot come from that place. Hmm. We need to draw, you know, secularists, I should say, need to draw the argument from somewhere else.
Wow, yeah. There's a lot to that observation, Veronica. We have Madison and Jefferson, God bless. We even have George Washington at points, who is a very ambiguous and ambivalent figure on these issues. And there have been arguments for half a century about what George Washington believed. But the truth of the matter is, and I'll explain to you why I've come to this conclusion, I really think the strong legal grounding of secularism is more a mid-20th century thing than it is a 19th century thing. In the 19th century, we see the seeds of the American secular vision, but we don't have the secular vision there. And perhaps a mistake that some secular activists make is they try to go back to the Founding Fathers only to find out that their opponents on the Christian right have as many Founding Fathers, if not more, to cite against them. And this has always been a bit of a problem. Why do I believe that? Because I was trained, Veronica, as a biblical scholar, and I have this obsession. This is another book. It's another Jacques Berlinerblau. I am not a huge fan of original documents and people claiming they can strain out the original intention of an author, right? If you're a biblical scholar, you're nodding your head with me right now, putting down your coffee and, you know, giving somebody a high five, because we all deal with this, right? I'm not comfortable with the idea that we can somehow get back into the mindset of people living 2,500 or 200 years ago. We can know precisely what they meant. And if we could, we'd have to live by their absolute precise words. To use an awful cliche, the Constitution is a living, breathing document. But I didn't say that. But in fact, it is. I mean, it changes. We change as a people. We have to calibrate our society to the world we actually live in.
You're in a lonely position, aren't you?
I think it's just me.
You've got somebody out there high-fiving each other, but I think a lot of people put a lot of stock in what the Founding Fathers, and we're always going to argue about that, is the gold standard of what's right about America.
And they should. And they should put stock in the Founding Fathers. That's my personal idiosyncrasy. I'm just here to help people who are thinking through secularism understand that they can't, the Founding Fathers are no longer a silver bullet the way they were in the 50s and 60s, where I think we had a naive reading of American history. And there was this great separationist narrative, right, that, you know, Jefferson was a proto-ACLU member, right, and Washington and Hamilton, right, were out looking for any creche they found on any lawn and with a sword, right, dismembering the plastic figure. I think that's really, really wrong, and it doesn't help secularists to ignore that you do have voices at the founding that really do think of this as a Christian nation. And those who brought this to my attention were generally conservative Christian scholars working in the academy, and their research is good and their research is sound, and I think they're correct. There are also some legal scholars who are not necessarily conservative Christians who have also made this point. And look, a fact is a fact. We have to be kind of fact-based. There's a lot, there are many different opinions back there as to what this country should be, and many of those opinions assume we are a nation under God and we are a Christian nation.
I want to get to one more phone call before the hour is up. We go next to Maddie in Waupaca. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I'd like to say that I consider myself to be a devout Christian. However, I've been appalled at the way that Christian radio has been used by the Republican Party. I like the music on Christian radio, but so often they call them, there's one channel that calls himself the Christian Information Station, and they're just pro-Republican and anti-Democrat. And I thought of writing them a letter and saying, you know, give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and give unto God that which is God. And I'd like to hear your comments about that.
All right, thanks, Maddie.
Thank you, Maddie. And I want to just stress, and Maddie, you got it, that this secular vision has no problem with the Maddies of the world. Those who are pious, devout believers can be secular. Now, Maddie is reaching back to her scriptures, and she's finding a fairly obvious biblical verse and sequence of biblical verses that indicate Christians ought not get involved in politics. There are other verses, by the way. You can read the Bible in a variety of ways. Another thing that Maddie calls attention to is this very thick complex network of kind of conservative Christian activist institutions, radio stations, lecture circuit speakers, DVDs that people have, and they can peddle online resources. And what we see is a sort of coupling, a commingling of Christian worldview, evangelical Christian worldview in particular, which they often refer to as biblical worldview, and the policies of the Republican Party. I have no problem with either. It's when they come together the way they come together, which I think is extremely problematic.
Well, thank you, Maddie, for that phone call. And Jacques, thank you for joining us this hour. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Veronica. It was a lot of fun.
Our guest this hour, Jacques Berliner-Blau. He teaches at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. He blogs at the Chronicle of Higher Education and is host of the Secular Center and Faith Complex. We were talking about his latest book this morning. It's called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. A big thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour and for fielding your phone calls, and to Rhonda Fanning for technical direction. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.